In 2003, Andy Rubin, one of the four founding fathers of Android Incorporated, stated the company's mission to develop smarter mobile devices that are more aware of a user's location and preferences. This was long before he became the Andy Rubin you know from Google, but after he got the nickname Android, while at Apple at the end of the 80s. Rubin, Joe Britt, and Matt Hershenson are credited for birthing the idea of cloud-based mobile computing and an associated applications marketplace with the company Danger Inc. and the T-Mobile Sidekick. That slide-out display mobile communicator, Handspring's Visor, an offspring of the Palm Pilot, and the Research in Motion 850, the OG BlackBerry, are the foundation stones of the smartphone industry we have today. All three devices relied on North American engineering and design, and the combination went on to birth the Android operating system and the iPhone, the champions of modern smartphones. There was one Chinese company that had a legitimate claim to the global smartphone throne. I am, of course, referring to Huawei. In 2019, Huawei was about to ascend to the crown of largest smartphone manufacturer on the planet, until a certain US President Donald Trump intervened in the May of that year, placing the company on the so-called entities list. Landing on this list meant being banned from working with American companies. Without access to that North American technology supply chain, the company was quickly dethroned. But it is mounting a small comeback, at least in South Africa, on the back of an integrated ecosystem play. In this episode, you'll hear about this strategy from Akram Mohammed, the Vice President of Operations for Huawei Consumer Business Group in South Africa. He speaks from a local perspective, and all of his opinions are his own. Welcome to Unencrypted, a podcast that tells the tale of technology, where it comes from, where it's going, and how it affects you. I'm Lindsay Shooters, and each week I add another chapter to this epic by chronicling the latest hardware releases and hearing from the industry leaders. That journey starts now, but first. Here comes the money. Here we go. Money. Unencrypted is brought to you by Advert, the sports broadcast technology company that is democratizing advertising for Africa. Advert partners with global rights holders to secure virtual feeds coming into Africa from the world's biggest sports leagues. These feeds are centralized, enabling simpler access for brands and agencies. Brands active in Africa now have direct access to tens of millions of sports fans during the moments that matter most to them, and your campaigns live on in the highlights packages after the final whistle. Do you want to get your brand baked into the broadcast on the biggest global stage? Request a demo today at advert.com. ADDVIRTT.com. It's ADDVIRTT.com. And find the best packages to increase your reach.
It goes back to when the sanctions hit us and the challenges started in 2019. Most people, whether it was media, tech journalists, the industry at large, expected Huawei to be non-existent in probably a 12-month period. That's how harsh the sanctions are. And history has proven that other companies that went through similar challenges eventually folded.
Let's not pretend that the Trump administration's suspicions weren't based on truths. In 2003, Cisco filed a lawsuit against Huawei for copying source code and violating intellectual property rights. In 2012, Cisco's then chief legal officer, Mark Chandler, wrote a scathing post on the company's corporate blog detailing how this lawsuit differed from smartphone patent battles, where, I quote, "Parties try to protect and grow their market share by suing each other over broad patents where no direct copying is required, let alone even knowledge that a patent exists." The links to the Chinese government that is also the cornerstone of the ongoing ban is also based on fact. Huawei Technologies Corporation was founded in 1987 by Ren Zhangfei, who in 1968 joined the military in the Infrastructure Engineering Corps, and then was drafted into the People's Liberation Army in 1974. He left the army after 11 years of service, but still maintained contacts within the Chinese Communist Party. Huawei began producing PBX phone switches with imported components before developing its own switches to sell the first entirely Chinese-produced switch, which it sold to hotels and small enterprises. It was with its JK1000 office telephone that the company first tasted the sting of failure. A stubborn refusal to adopt digital circuitry meant immediate commercial failure. But at the time, the company had won a major contract building the telecoms network for the People's Liberation Army, after telling the CCP Secretary General that a nation without its own switching equipment was like one that lacked its own army. Ironic then that Huawei's major business became building telecommunications networks for countries around the world, including a network data storage in the US in partnership with Symantec. In 2004, the company put out its first cell phone, the C300. In 2009, it released its first Android device, the U8220. That borrowed the trackball ideas from what HTC was doing at the time. Huawei only registered on my radar in 2013 with the Ascend P6, which was the closest I've ever seen an Android phone try and copy the iPhone aesthetic. Huawei would from then on forge its own design path that culminated in the P9 and its Leica-branded dual camera. The year was 2016, and people were finally taking Huawei seriously. Akram Mohammed was there for the P9 unveiling at the Sandton Convention Center in Johannesburg. The next time Huawei would grace that stage was a couple of months ago to release its 2022 slate of flagship devices.
So I agree that it is an extension of the Huawei ecosystem. It is an additional screen. It is all those lovely things that you have spoken about. But I would not want to discount the phone aspect of it or a smartphone aspect of it for the lack of GMS. And the reason I say that is, of course, it's not going to be a device for everybody. We're not under any illusions about the lack of GMS and the learning curve and the adaptations. And some people call it the hoops that they might need to jump to be able to get it. But for those that are aware of how to do these things and how to access your applications, I think it is a great experience. And then if you go and you compare it to what's available on the market, it boxes in the same weight class, if not better. And what has happened now is, you know, you find most people, I mean, they talk about GMS. They talk about the GMS ecosystem and, oh, I don't have Google, or I can't Google, and there's a misconception, or I don't have the Google Play Store, but you have App Gallery. So for most people, it is specific applications that are concerned and not the lack of GMS per se. Okay, because if you look at the kits that GMS provides, it's mostly the developer tools that are required. And Huawei has catered for that adequately with HMS. So from a consumer perspective, when you and I speak and we say, well, we don't have Google or we don't have GMS, we're talking about, well, how do I then run YouTube? How do I run Gmail on my device? Do I have access to WhatsApp? Can I be able on this beautiful screen that expands have a great experience with Netflix? You know, these are the important things. And when you talk about it on an app level, I think that is where we have done a lot to make those apps available. And they most certainly are on the Mate XS 2 as well. So if you are able to know that and you are able to port, I mean, I'm using the Mate X 2 myself. I would consider myself a power user. And to be quite fair, when we first started in 2019 with HMS, I struggled to use an HMS device because not all of my applications could work. And I'm not talking about just the popular ones like streaming services, etc., but I'm talking about even little things like my CCTV cameras at home. Perhaps those applications did not run. Something that I needed to run my home automation system. So we, over the last 3 years, we've ensured that we've brought in and ported most of the popular, and I think right now we are sitting with a 99.7% app availability rate. And if you're looking at our consumer net satisfaction score on HMS as a whole and app availability, we are sitting on 98% with that as well in South Africa. So, you know, that is testimony to say that is a huge improvement. So yes, at 40K, but also what are you getting for 40K? As you mentioned, the hardware is incredible. We're not expecting to sell as many of those as we would sell our P series. That's for sure. But at the same time, we want the consumers to see the Huawei capability. And it's certainly there in terms of that build quality, that material, the design language, and the entire package. I think if you look at it as a package, first sales have started yesterday, in fact, in South Africa, and they look very, very positive. So again, that is something that gives us confidence.
It was hard to watch Huawei flounder in the wilderness of non-Google services. Harder still, when the local market loved it so dearly and was now left without options. But in 2022, there is reason for excitement again, mainly because Huawei is confident in its new ecosystem and not mentioning Harmony OS anymore, at least in this market. Harmony OS was said to be a multi-kernel distributed operating system that selects suitable kernels from the abstraction layer for devices with diverse resources. A kernel is the core of the operating system. So kernels turn the software requests into processing instructions so that the camera takes a picture when you press the shutter button in the app. Android has a Linux kernel. Harmony OS has also been found to run a Linux kernel, but with some clever device connection switching being done in the abstraction layer. The only thing Harmony OS lacks is Google services, which is crucial to experiencing a smarter mobile device that is aware of your location and preferences. The preferences part is because Google already knows everything about Android user preferences. When Google acquired Android Inc. for $50 million in 2005, it immediately put it to work in a BlackBerry mimicking prototype. The iPhone launched in 2007, and the rest is history.
But we cannot lose focus on the core aspect of what our business was established on, which is continuously innovate and try for the best. Until such time as you don't survive anymore, you continue pushing the boundaries. So if you don't have access to something, find a way to create it. And if you're looking at our software ecosystem, that's exactly what we've done. So instead of waiting that perhaps one day it could come back, perhaps one day these things would go away. No, we're not waiting for that. It might not be ideal now, but in a couple years' time, it's going to be something that revolutionizes the industry. So that's what we are looking at, and we are willing to bite that bullet and go through those struggles in the short term. And it's the same thing when it comes to our hardware. I mean, we're one of the few companies, if you look at our research and development spend, and we speak about that so much, but it's because we are truly proud of that. We honestly put in the investment to be able to build for the future. And I think that is something that has paid off in these challenging times, because it didn't only help us to survive, but also helped us, the word you use, to stay relevant. And I think will continuously help us to do so in future too. When you talk about, devices, future-proofing devices, it's not just about one device. You know, it's very difficult to future-proof one device because they change so rapidly. But this is why we talk about the super device. And when you look at all of them, and it's a bit hard to get the concept out there now, but when you start seeing them built up over a period of time, when you have the ecosystem of devices together and how they work, it's almost like a modular kind of concept. You know, so instead, how do you future-proof? Well, you don't change the entire thing. You change one aspect of it, one component of that entire super device experience. And then you are gone on to the next level. And I think that's where it's going. I mean, you don't find us upgrading our TV sets every single year, at home. Most of the equipment we use at home lasts us for a long time. So once you see a smartphone as an enabler and as an entry point to various other technologies in your life, and then you find everything else as complementary, especially with our multi-device collaboration now, you'd say, okay, well, if I need a better camera, or I need faster speeds, or I need better audio, can I just change one thing from this ecosystem to get that, rather than changing everything? And I think that's where you start, hopefully in the future, looking at an opportunity to future-proof your technology experiences.
What Huawei South Africa presented on that stage in 2022, however, is a step away from the smartphone. Led by the Mate XS2 foldable, where the screen wraps around the outside and doesn't fold inwards like a book in the way that Samsung Z Fold does, the new slate of products is a tablet and laptop first series, and a desktop class browser is a neat workaround for those missing Google services on the tablet and on the Mate XS2 foldable. While Huawei's wounds are deep, the recovery plan focused on a broader device ecosystem comes in an era when people have rediscovered the relationship with their PC. It's a perfect time to be selling one of the best looking and performing Windows laptops, a mesh router system, and sensibly priced health and fitness wearables. Huawei is betting its future on its ecosystem, and this deals a lot of processors built on top of the software layer. But that's a story for another day.